Did you notice the name of this episode when you signed in?
2020 pun.
It's genius, right?
Oh, I just got it.
Do you love it?
I just got it. I thought it was like, insert pun here. Like there's going to be some kind of 2020 pun here. But then I was like, but it's 2021. Why would you want a 2020 pun?
I sat down to try and come up with a temporary title for the episode, which I usually do and attach to the recording. And then sometimes that title winds up making it all the way through to when we post, and sometimes it gets edited, or sometimes it pulls something different out of the episode and use it as a title or something. Mm-hmm. But I was trying to come up with a title, and I was like, New Year something, like, oh, year in retrospect, like year end retrospective to like 2021. Oh, wait, like 2020 fun. Like, and then I started coming up with all these really bad 2021 puns. And then I was like, wait a minute,
a meta pun.
I'm not even embarrassed. Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with my co-host, Alan Sutterby. Hey, Alan.
Hi, Shale.
We're two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it. Now let's get on with the talking.
Oh, I like that one. You look folksy.
What should we call your podcast studio, basement podcast studio? Does it have a name?
The Beaver Wagon.
Well, we'll workshop it.
It's because they can't see, but it's because it's wood. It's got the wood paneling.
Paneling, yeah. It kind of makes sense to me. To somebody that just heard that off the cuff, it may seem like you were saying something that is totally inappropriate.
When you're a kid and the wood paneled cars drive, they don't make them anymore. But in the 90s, when a wood paneled car drove by, you'd punch your friend and say Beaver Wagon.
Oh, actually, that wasn't a thing for me.
Really?
But yeah, I think I've heard of it, but yeah, that wasn't really a thing for us. We had the punch buggy thing, but no right. Beaver wagon thing. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. I was actually like, I was like halfway to suggesting Beaver Den.
Oh, which, that's good.
You know, because it's kind of like a den. You know,
that makes more sense. Like, it doesn't have wheels, so it's not really a wagon.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
But yeah, the reason that the recording on my end is so sonorous is because of all of the vintage cookbooks and the wood paneling in this room that I recorded.
Man, we should post an Instagram shot at some point.
I'm wrapped in a polar fleece blanket. It's so cold.
Not of you necessarily right now in this particular moment. I want you to feel comfortable wearing whatever brand of pajamas you want to record the podcast. But maybe at some point we can actually like get a nice camera and take a photo of your beaver den.
Sure.
I don't know what my podcast studio is called.
Yours looks like a spaceship.
I know. Yeah, really, kind of.
It looks cold, like spiritually, not like in terms of temperature. It's very austere.
That's like, that's kind of my aesthetic, I think.
Yeah.
It's like minimalistic, austere. I don't tend to put like a lot of like art and paintings and things up on my walls. I tend to have things around that I like as decoration. Like, I don't know, you can't probably see it right now, Alan, but if I tilt my camera up.
Oh, yeah. Figurines.
I got a shelf right behind me that has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 Lego
Star Trek.
Star Wars spaceships.
Oh, yeah. Star Wars. Yeah.
I know you know the difference, Alan. And then I have another shelf over on the other side that has like a whole bunch of different colored and different shaped and sized Rubik's cubes.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I could see getting some art in here at some point. I do somewhat agree that it feels a little clinical in here, but I need to do some more acoustic treatment to the walls. Mm-hmm. And so there may not be a lot of wall room left after I finish all the acoustic treatment that I want to do.
Like
right
you're doing
now,
renovations to make to fix the acoustics?
No, just I'll be putting Oh man, this is a tangent that we shouldn't have gone off on.
Oh boy.
This is probably boring for most people, but I'm just like, you can see behind me, there's like six kind of like gray panels on the wall back there.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are six on the wall right in front of me. They're like made out of an acoustically absorbent material. And so they help reduce echo and in the room and like reflection. Mm-hmm. So anyone who's like a real audio nerd could go back and listen to the first few episodes of the podcast and notice that my voice is definitely a little more, has a little more reverb to it.
Oh, is that right?
I figured out some techniques to like take some of that out. And then also did a little bit of treatment to the room to make it sound less echoey.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still more things that I have to do and want to do, like probably in the next year, just to make it. Cause like right now, I also like before we record, I hang like a blanket up over the wall where my door is, like between my closet door and the door to my studio.
Mm-hmm.
I like hang a blanket up over there because it's just like a blank solid wall and it does a lot of echoing. So putting a blanket over there really helps dampen things.
Mm-hmm. But Shale, mm-hmm. the start of this conversation was, you mentioned that we're still in the holidays when we're recording.
Yes.
This.
Okay.
And
sorry.
You had an idea in our last conversation, or you and your brother did, to make a turkey liver pate.
Right. Yeah.
And I did that.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. But I haven't.
Oh, great.
Haven't,
well, so are we. We're doing it tomorrow. But,
oh, really? Cool.
Yeah.
So you found the livers.
Yeah. We got some livers from Marius. And he also got some from, what's that new grocery store called that everybody's like freaking out about?
I don't know. I'll just Google grocery
Wait,
store.
I'll do a little like editing magic here, and maybe I'll accidentally remember the name of it. What do you know? It's called Friesen Bros.
Oh, okay, yeah, I know that.
You have you heard of that? Yeah,
yeah. I haven't been.
Have you been there?
I haven't been to one in Edmonton, but like when I
Me neither.
Where do I go? Like in Drumheller. When we stay in Drumheller, we always end up at Friesen Bros there.
Okay. And, yeah. Cool. Yeah. That's apparently they have like a lot of stuff that they make on like on the premises. That's like pretty good quality and stuff.
Mm-hmm. And is it like, isn't Lex the corporate chef there or something? Am I making,
oh, is he?
I think so.
Oh, I had no idea.
I haven't talked to him in a long time, but
right
when he left, Baijiu, that's where he was headed, was to Friesen Brothers. So I don't know if he's still
there.
Oh, that's
interesting. I didn't actually know that. I didn't know what his plan was. And I don't know. Like, I'm pretty sure I follow him on Instagram, but I feel like I haven't seen anything from him in a long time. So, mm-hmm. I don't know. That's how I follow a lot of my chef's friends' careers, is like, see where they're posting their food pictures
from. Yeah, exactly.
From.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
I made turkey liver pate. I haven't tasted it yet. It's still being pressed. I probably won't have it until Christmas morning, but...
cool.
We were working with loads and loads of turkey at the last week of classes at Nate.
Right.
And there was all these livers ending up in stock pots. And so I rescued a pound of livers from being boiled in stock. And then instead of like, usually my like rustic pate is like a pound or whatever, 500 grams of liver and 500 grams of pork shoulder.
Yeah.
But I tried to make an all turkey one. Where like if I'm making all chicken sausages, I'll use, I think it's like three parts leg meat, like thigh meat, two parts skin and two parts breast meat. And the skin is what's bringing the fat to the party. So I tried that mixture with the turkey meat from my turkey.
Yeah.
And I think it'll, like I said, I haven't tasted
it'll
it
be
yet,
good.
But
sweet.
Yeah.
Did you put pink salt in it?
Yeah, like a teaspoon or so, yeah. Is that weird to put pink salt?
We don't
salt
have any. I don't have any here. Like I searched high and low and I can't find mine, so.
Do you want me to leave some in
I
the mailbox?
I was thinking about just doing it without. What's that?
Do you want me to leave you some in my mailbox?
Yeah, would you?
Yeah.
And I could just like sneak by and grab it tomorrow?
Mm-hmm.
Morning or something?
Yep.
Yeah, that'd be great. Just a couple teaspoons?
Sure.
Sweet. Do you want to quickly run down your method for me? And then I'll tell you what I'm planning on doing. And you can tell me whether I'm a crazy person or not.
Sure. Like I do what I think is a very classic rustic technique, like what would be called a pâté grand-mère. Mm-hmm. And it's the, I think it's called like the gratinade style. So like you sear the livers. Okay. Like I said, it's one part liver to one part pork shoulder typically. Sear the livers, remove them from the pan, sweat onion or shallot, add brandy or cider or whatever your spirit is, reduce briefly. And then what? Grind the pork shoulder and then mix that ground meat with your seared livers and your soaked, like stale bread soaked in milk with egg.
You don't grind the livers as well?
Well, you don't have to, but I usually give the meat to grind. So like I'll grind the pork shoulder.
Oh, I see.
And then I'll mix it with everything else. And then I'll grind that entire mixture as well. You don't have to, I don't think, but that's what I've done.
Okay.
And then, into like I have a classic like Le Creuset ceramic tureen.
Yeah.
And bake it in a water bath. And for quantities, like to fill that tureen, 500 grams of liver, 500 grams of pork shoulder, 2 eggs, 2 buns soaked in, I can't remember, a half cup of milk or something. And that's it. And then, cook to temp and then pressed.
Cool. You put any fresh herbs in there? Or?
Usually I just do a small amount of dried herb in with the onion or shallot. So like this one I used savory, like dried summer savory.
Cool. You don't bard it with anything inside the tureen?
Not usually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. No, you tell me if I'm crazy or not.
Okay.
I don't have a grinder.
Okay.
So the options were chop up a pork shoulder by hand or braise a pork shoulder and then basically turn, like make what's going to be like a half pate, half rillette. So I'm braising the pork shoulder tonight. I'm sous vide-ing it overnight. In the morning, we'll pour everything off and separate the fat away from it. And then pull all of the pork meat. So we have pulled pork. Then I'm going to take our turkey livers, which we've already soaked. We milked them for 2 days. And then I have like 6 chicken hearts as well. So I'm just going to chop those by hand because it's not very much. I'm going to sear the livers, chop the chicken hearts, put everything, like put some sweated shallots, some fresh thyme, probably some parsley. Mix the livers with that stuff, add in a bunch of the rendered pork fat to the livers situation. And then basically blend that in my Vitamix till it's like maybe, you know, not completely smooth, maybe still a little bit chunky, and then mix that all with the pulled pork. So like, you know, instead of in the situation where if I were making a rillette, I would just like mix the pulled pork with like pork fat basically to help bind it. I'm just going to bind the pulled pork with the livers and a bit of pork fat and then put that in the tureen, put it in the oven and bake it in a water bath.
It's not crazy at all. You're not going to use bread and milk and egg though?
I hadn't planned to, but once you started talking about it, I was like, oh yeah, I can probably use some extra binding, especially since I'm pre-cooking the pork. Yeah.
I think that's like, I've not really made that. Well, you know what, Shil, if you have time, you should look into, a Bavarian, preparation called Pressack, P-R-E-S-A-C-K, I think. It's something very similar to what you're describing, only they would use blood instead of the pureed livers. But like it's almost like head cheese. If head cheese and pate had a baby together, and I think that they, because they have like coarse chunks of pork kind of like what you have. I think that they usually bind it with bread, milk, egg.
Okay.
Like, I think that what you describe obviously would be tasty. I can't picture how well it would slice.
It might just not hold together super well when you go to slice it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was kind of, that was actually my biggest concern. Mm-hmm. So yeah, cool. Great. That's a great tip. Thanks a lot, Alan.
No problem, Bob.
How far in are we? And we haven't even introduced our topic yet. I think before we introduce our topic, I may have a little bit of follow-up here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, just in the last episode, I talked about I was going to be doing an online cooking demo, breakfast for dinner, mm-hmm. for a charity called...
The Breakfast Club.
Breakfast Club of Canada, yeah. Breakfast Club, exactly. Yeah, and... it all went really well. It was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. There weren't like tons of people on the stream. Like, I think there was probably somewhere in the neighborhood of like 30 to 40 people or something.
Oh,
but yeah, it took a few hours. I did the cocktails. Everyone really seemed to enjoy it. We got like a lot of really good feedback. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure we almost made our donation goal if we didn't make it. Like, I didn't actually look at it on the, we were like creeping up to it, and I didn't check it on like the last day of donations. Mm-hmm. And also, like, I'm donating all of the, like, I was being paid for the time that I put into it, but all of that's being donated. Unfortunately, like, the actual event closed already, so I can't donate it to our campaign, but all of that will be going to the Breakfast Club of Canada too.
Cool.
And with that, we pretty much made our donation goal. So mm-hmm. that's awesome. Cool. I think we'll probably wind up doing it again next year, and I'll try and promote it a little bit better on the podcast so that if people are listening, they can maybe have some time to consider getting a ticket or mm-hmm. something like that. But yeah, it was a lot of fun. Like, I basically cooked the meal and just like walked everybody through what I was doing while I was doing it. And then there was somebody there who was kind of like monitoring the chat on the stream.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And they would just, if someone asked questions in the chat, then they would just relay those questions to me, and I would like go into more detail on certain things that I was doing or certain techniques that I was doing or whatever. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of fun.
Cool. And what was the crowd favorite for the either drink or
food? Man, good question. I mean, probably the dessert.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, everybody's like usually impressed with like,
which was
bread,
the
pudding
potted
and,
sorry, how did,
yeah,
what was,
well,
the
it wasn't
again?
Potted. It was like, it was French toast bread pudding, but it was only right. French toast in the way that you don't actually cut up the bread.
Yeah.
You just soak real actual pieces of toast. And then, like you were saying last time, like, you make, well, I made the base for what would be basically a set custard, mm-hmm. and then I dipped the bread in it, mm-hmm. and then layered the bread on top, like made layers of bread, kind of like a lasagna, and sprinkled a little bit of like brown sugar and cinnamon in between the layers. Mm-hmm. And then once I had stacked up all the bread, which was challah, I went to Bliss Bakery and
got a
couple of challahs and cut them up. And yeah, they were beautiful for that. It was mm-hmm. delicious.
Cool.
But yeah, then after you're done like stacking it up, then you pour the rest of the custard in and around, and then it just sort of like, you bake it in the oven and it sets. Some of the custard is like set around some of the holes where the bread doesn't quite join up. Mm-hmm. And so you get like some little bits of custard, and then you get some bits of bread pudding, and kind of, and then like you bake it a little bit with the tin foil off to get some like kind of like nice crispy sort of French toasty edges on the top. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, just flip it out, cut it up, served it with some fruit and some like brown sugar whipped cream.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
I also like, I made brown sugar whipped cream for like two things. One of the cocktails that I did was Irish coffee. Mm-hmm. And I made it so that it looks like a Guinness. Like, so you put coffee in the bottom, and then with like brown sugar and the whiskey, and like, and then you whip like soft peak whipped cream, mm-hmm. and then just kind of like spoon it on.
Yeah.
And because I made it with brown sugar, it's like, it's not exactly bright white, like it's slightly brown, and it looks almost exactly the same as the color of the head on a pint of Guinness. And so, yeah, the Irish coffee looked just like a pint of Guinness, which was pretty
cool. That's funny. I'm going to steal that.
Pretty fun. You should make one.
Because I do make that regularly. Well, sorry, not regularly throughout the year. I usually make one on or around St. Patrick's Day. But
oh, yeah. See, so perfect. Well, if you need a bottle of Bushmills with which to make some, I use literally like 4 ounces out of like a 2.6 of Bushmills that I have here. So
that's Protestant whiskey, Shale. I'd never drink that.
Oh, that's right. We're back to the politics. I forgot. Actually, someone asked that during the demo. I was like, I have a bottle of Bushmills here. And they were like, somebody asked a political question about like whether that's like, you know, like Northern Irish whiskey,
right?
Or yeah. And I was like, actually, I don't know enough about Irish politics even make anything like to even have a witty retort to that joke. Yeah. So I'm just going to completely avoid it altogether and hope that I don't offend anyone. But
it's actually like, I don't know. I don't actually know anything about Bushmills in particular, but that is a line from The Wire. McNulty.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Jimmy McNulty orders Jameson's at a bar and they only have Bushmills. And he says, Bushmills? That's Protestant whiskey.
Anyways, oh, man. What a great show, The Wire. So, yeah, went great.
Awesome.
And hopefully next year I can do a little better job of promoting it. Although I did promote the podcast on it a few times and they sent the link to the RSS feed to the podcast, mm-hmm. like out with the invitation. So I don't know if you're listening and you saw that demo, welcome to our fun little tight-knit community of listeners. Mm-hmm. Yeah, onwards and upwards though, Alan, what are we oh, wait, but the last thing, that this is like something that we almost touched on, but then wound up on a tangent instead. Do you have, since it's our like second consecutive holiday party situation, do you have a beverage there to keep you company?
No, I don't.
Oh, no.
Not even water.
That's so sad. Well, I have a stout from Town Square. Liquid something, can't remember what it's called. It's really good though. It's intense.
Yeah,
comes in like small cans and it's like, I don't know, 8.5 or 9% or something. So
oh, is that right?
Yeah, but it's really, if you like stouts that like are not overly sweet but have that like really syrupy mouthfeel, it's really good.
Cool.
For something that's locally made. And then for when I run out of that, I have about 1.5 ounces here of 1800 Añejo tequila.
Oh, is that? Yep.
Yeah, which I had to buy a bottle of to make eggnog with, and I had a little bit left.
So. There's tequila in your eggnog?
So the eggnog recipe that I talked about on the Christmas or on the holiday spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
The original recipe, I don't know if I fully remembered when I was talking about it on the last episode, but the original recipe, like I said that I got the recipe through James Grant, but that he had like sort of like adapted it from another recipe.
Right.
And the recipe that he had adapted it from was from Jeffrey Morgenthaler.
Oh, okay.
And so who I don't know a whole lot about, but he's a pretty, I think, well-renowned bartender in the States.
Mm-hmm.
And if you like Google Jeffrey Morgenthaler eggnog, you'll find the recipe. Clyde Common, is that the, I think that's the name of the bar that he was at when he, yeah. So he has a blog, jeffreymorgenthaler.com, and the name of the recipe is Clyde Common's Tequila Sherry Eggnog. And in that recipe, this is like really going down a rabbit hole now, but
an old gray rabbit hole.
An old gray rabbit hole. Sorry. Yeah. In the recipe, in Jeffrey Morgenthaler's recipe, like he gives his recipe, which is like made with Añejo tequila and Amontillado sherry.
Mm-hmm.
But like down below, I think it's on that same page. He talks about like the recipe for eggnog that he kind of adapted his recipe from.
Right. Yeah.
So like the recipe that I sort of wound up using is like a third hand adapted recipe, which I then readapted. Mm-hmm. So Jeffrey Morgenthaler's recipe uses añejo tequila and amontillado sherry mm-hmm. as the like spirit components. But the first year that I made it, I didn't have any añejo tequila in my cabinet. Mm-hmm. And I also like was mostly serving it to like my family and stuff.
Right.
And I thought that, you know, because like rum and eggnog is like, you know, so classic. And so I was just like, okay, I'll just replace the tequila with spiced rum and then it'll taste like the eggnog that everyone knows and loves.
Right.
Sort yep. of. Right. But mm-hmm. with like a little bit of a sherry twist. Mm-hmm. And that turned out to be really great. And so I've been making that version with replacing the tequila with spiced rum for the last 4 years, I guess. Mm-hmm. But this year, the first time I went to make it, my sister and I were like decorating our like Christmas tree and the main floor of our house with like our very few Spartan, what did you call my room?
Cold and clinical. I don't remember.
Cold and clinical. Yeah. We were decorating our downstairs and our Christmas tree with the very few cold and clinical Christmas decorations that I've allowed us to have. Mm-hmm. And when we were going to do that decoration, I was like, oh, I should like just make some eggnog. I had some cream in the fridge. I had some milk in the fridge. I was like, I'll just like look through the liquor cabinet and see what I have. What I didn't have was spiced rum. Oh. But what I did have was like an airplane bottle of non-añejo tequila, mm-hmm. like just like an airplane bottle of I don't even know what mm-hmm. kind of tequila. So like, so what's that? 2 ounces, I think.
I think so. Yeah.
In an airplane bottle. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then like, in order to make enough for us to each have like a decent sized glass, I needed like 4 ounces of whatever, like what would have been spiced rum. Mm-hmm. So I put the 2 ounces of tequila in, and then I put in 2 ounces of bourbon.
Okay. Yeah.
And then I had some sherry, and so I put in the sherry, so that was normal. Mm-hmm. But then when we drank it, I was like, I could taste the tequila, and I was like, oh, I see what this is doing. Like, this is actually like really good. Mm-hmm. And so then it was kind of my intention this year when I made the recipe to like do it with tequila instead, and just like, you know. But I didn't really have time to stock up, and I didn't have time to go out and source like a reasonably good añejo tequila that also wasn't like $90 for a 2.6 or something. Mm-hmm, right. Mm-hmm. So, but then in the last couple of days I've been running around doing a whole bunch of like Christmas shopping and stopping by liquor stores to grab various things for certain projects that we're working on and yada, yada, yada. So I found like a reasonably priced bottle of añejo tequila. Mm-hmm. And I brought it home with the intention of turning it into a batch of eggnog, which I'm probably going to make tomorrow. But for now, it means I have some to sip on.
Just tequila, straight tequila.
There's like 3 ice cubes in here, Alan. Yeah.
Okay,
you never sip on straight tequila?
I'm sure I have, but not regularly.
I mean, it's got like tequila is such a great spirit. Like mm-hmm. it's got its like own set of beautiful like characteristics. Some of those things being like way different from like a lot of other sipping spirits that people are super into, like scotch or bourbon or whatever.
Yeah, totally.
Like it's got like
vegetal
these,
kind of
like
notes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's got grassy, a lot more like kind of grassy notes and like tastes in that way, kind of like more vibrant. And then the aged stuff has like, you know, barrel age characteristics as well. Mm-hmm. And yeah, mm-hmm. I don't know. It's really good.
If I remember,
there's one thing I'm not though, it's a bartender.
Oh. I think that, okay. I meant to do more research on this, but I think that when you brought up James Grant in our last conversation, we kind of like casually and offhandedly said, oh yeah, he won some, he was like a national.
Oh, yeah,
something,
yeah, yeah.
Something.
Right.
But he's like,
do you have follow-up about that?
Well, like he was the I don't even know how to say it now, but like he basically won a, you know, the best bartender in the world award
Like International Bartender of the Year.
Yeah.
Right?
So I don't know how to say the name of the company, but Diageo, I don't know, World Class Global Bartender.
Right.
Which, so I hope we were a little bit offhand about it, but it was a
major it's award. A big deal, and he's like an amazing bartender, and he's very talented, and he deserves those types of awards. Like the stuff that he does is like very, very good, very smart, very intentional, and he's super passionate about it. And I understand what you mean, but like I think if it felt that way, it was because I was downplaying my own ignorance, rather than like downplaying his accomplishment. But if it came off like I was downplaying James's accomplishment, that wasn't the intention.
You didn't want to put yourself in the position where you had to try and pronounce Diageo. I don't know.
Exactly. But I'm Alan's sure that's got not how the you balls say it. To just like roll up on that sentence and be like, you know what? I don't know what this word is, but.
I'll look. Yeah, I'll learn that this week, how to say that.
Sweet.
You know what, Shale? That kind of reminds me of something.
Okay.
Like we're planning a kind of year in review, a kind of look back, a retrospective on the year 2021. Mm-hmm. Lots to talk about, even though we've been recording for an hour already. And so something like this word Diageo. what I've appreciated most about doing this podcast over the last, whatever it's been, 10 or 11 months. First of all, is that I get to hang out with you because I'm actually like so bad at maintaining relationships that I've formed in a workplace. And then when I leave that workplace, it's very rare that I'm able to maintain the relationship. So for that reason alone, this has been fantastic to have these conversations with you. But also having the conversations and it being a kind of like somewhat, well, casual and improvised and fluid conversation, stuff comes up all the time that I don't know about. And I make a note. And then usually like
and then you feel compelled to go out and do a little bit of research about it. So that if you have to wind up talking about it again on the podcast, or even if like, you know, it's like a gap that you have and then it like sort of like, And then you want to make sure that you don't have to suffer like the micro embarrassment of not knowing about the thing that you thought you should have known about in the first place.
Yeah. And actually that's like one of my main reservations when we started out was like, oh, well, it's not like writing a blog post where you can just go back and edit it if you made a mistake. Like it's, but I've just kind of accepted it and used it as an opportunity to learn more. And so usually like I have my little list going as we're talking. And then usually, you know, just a few minutes after we finish the recording, I look it up and sometimes we share it as follow-up the next week, or sometimes I share it with you just for interest sake, but it's been fun. I've actually learned a lot of odds and ends over the last 20 odd recordings.
Yeah, this is what going to be number 24, I believe. Sure, number 24. Somebody's staring at it in their podcast player right now, and it definitely says number 23, and they're like, oh.
Amateur hour, yeah.
I mean, like, I feel that. Like, sometimes that happens to me, like, before, while we're preparing for an episode, I'm like, oh, man, I want to talk about this, but how informed am I about this? And sometimes it'll, like, you know, cause me to want to go out and do a little, additional research beforehand. Or, sometimes I find a gap of knowledge while we're like recording and I'm like, oh man, I wish I had known about that when we were having that conversation, and I will go out and research it after. Mm-hmm. And like, I feel the same way about the podcast, like as you related it to a blog post, like, yeah, you can't, I mean, like we do edit the podcast, but I mean, we're not,
not very much. Like,
no, honestly, like I'm not taking out much content. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I'm, you know, taking out like, you know, little slip ups or like ums and ahs and things like that. But for the most part, like, you know, what we talk about or what we know or what we don't know on the podcast is like all reflected in the final edit, like for mm-hmm. the most part.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I guess sometimes I've taken out a couple tangents that feel like they go nowhere and don't really add anything to the conversation.
Not often. No.
Oh, no, that never happens. Right. Yeah. Cause I usually leave them in.
Exactly.
But like, I think that, if you can just sort of like allow yourself to get past the idea that you can't really edit yourself and that, you know, like what we wind up saying in our conversation on the podcast is like, you know, what's going to air and that's what people are going to hear. And if you can kind of just like get over the initial kind of like reluctance or whatever, it's kind of freeing in terms of like, you know, like when you're writing a blog post, you want everything to like, or at least I don't know. Well, yeah, I guess if you look at the internet, maybe this is actually like a minority opinion, but like if I'm writing something that's going to be published, you know, like I want it to be accurate and I want it to be as well researched as possible. And it's nice because you can go back and like, you know, research things before you publish it and like really clean things up and do multiple passes and edits and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, which is cool, but it also lends itself to like, I guess like a level of scrutiny and perfectionism that oftentimes causes a little bit, at least for me, a little bit of like paralysis mm-hmm. in terms of wanting to do it. And like what for me, having accepted the fact that sometimes I'm going to sound like an idiot on the podcast has done is made it like, you know, like accepting that has made it feel a lot more free and easy in terms of being able to like create something that I like and that I'm proud of, you know, like mm-hmm. getting over that hump a little bit, but then also understanding that it's not always going to be perfect, but that's just the way it is. Like, mm-hmm. you know, kind of like frees me up to just, you know, feel comfortable talking about something that maybe I don't necessarily have all the answers for and I might sound dumb about for a second, but then I can maybe use that as some inspiration to go and do a little bit more research or come back and talk about it again once I have a better idea of what we're talking about or do some follow-up or that type of thing. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know, it you know, like the format of the fact that we're just sitting having a conversation makes it like fun and kind of freeing and easy to just like create some content every couple weeks.
I think that the description you just gave of recording a podcast is like a metaphor for life, Shale.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm saying is like, yeah, I agree, but like but like the structure of the podcast is what makes it like this gem that like, you know.
Yeah.
It's like the structure of the podcast is what makes it this like microcosm of like a good life that you can lead, you know, like,
but you know what I mean? Right. It's like, well, you're not going to be able to control everything. And of course you want it to be perfect, but you still got to get out there and do it, even if it's going to be
do it and just commit and like, yeah,
and
exactly.
And that's, and make corrections like, and
100%. And in my like everyday life, that is something that I struggle with. Like, mm-hmm. Like, on the daily, you know, mm-hmm. is just like, oh, like talking myself through the fear of failure for something that really truly doesn't matter whether I fail at or not, mm-hmm. or something, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
But you know, like once you start rolling on the podcast, you just like that, then you're in it, you know, like and that and if I could do that with the rest of my life, like reliably, if I could just get up every morning and just like roll through my life without a paralyzing fear of like failure in terms of most of the endeavors that I take on a daily basis, like that would be amazing.
Anyways, just kidding.
Speaking of which, what are we talking about tonight, Alan? I guess you kind of already introduced it. We're talking about, this is going to be like kind of a year-end retrospective. How does our 2020 and how was the podcast in 2020 and what are some of our favorite moments?
It was 2021 this year, Shale.
Oh, right. Okay, I'll try that again.
Don't you dare cut that out. That's one of the...
We're
just talking about
such a piece of gold. Yeah, thanks, Alan. It's 2021. I super embarrassed now. 2021. How was our 2021? How was the podcast? What are some of our favorite moments? What were some of maybe our favorite food-related experiences or meals or stuff that we did that was food-related in 2021? That's the topic. If we have to give it like a formal introduction.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of already started talking about some of this stuff.
Do you start with a broad? Abroad, this is what 2021 was like for me, or
I don't know. Do you think that's a scary, depressing thing for us to start to talk about, or do you think it's constructive, uplifting?
I don't know. I won't know until we do it. If you want okay, something fair. Lighter, I had just cherry picked some, no pun intended, some food memories from the year.
I don't want something lighter, Alan. Now, okay. Now that you've said it, I want to hear your 2021.
Oh, mine?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't want to talk about this the whole time, but it was an odd year because of the pandemic. It was for me, like for my work life, like this year, the last two academic terms, I was teaching evening dining, which, kind of lit up a part of my brain that hasn't been lit up in a long time, because so much of the cooking I did for, say 8 years or so was like not exclusively, but it was largely in casual spaces. It was cafes, and casual restaurants, catering and stuff like that. And we would do so-called fine dining and stuff, but, it wasn't something that I did daily since very early on in my career. And it's been a blast, honestly, and really invigorating in a way, like to be able to go back to that and think about, I don't think I had to think about plating in any serious way for those 8 years in casual service, because it's always just like, you plate it, it's tidy and simple and clean and there's not much to think about usually, but,
totally.
And, it also gave me a chance to, we've kind of talked about how kind of reactionary I am and how slow I am to take to say like modernist techniques and stuff like that. But I've been trying to force myself to learn more about it. And so the baby steps, like you and I had several conversations this year, not on the podcast, but in real life, about how to use a whipped cream siphon properly and troubleshoot some of my preparations with that. And so that's just one small example of the new to me stuff that I got to try this year. Food-wise, so much of my food life is like not professional and is my part of my family life and my home life. And a lot of that was interrupted this year, like the no cooking for large groups, because we would historically have people over for St. Patrick's Day and Easter and Thanksgiving and
solstice.
Yeah, exactly. Like, so a lot of that was interrupted, but there still was some nice home seasonal specialties and memories. So,
yeah. I came by your place one day for a donut this year. Was that this year?
I think that was the fall of last year. I think.
Okay. Yeah. What did I like? I came by your place this fall and
we had the pie.
That was the day that you had the brûlée pumpkin pie.
Yeah. So in lieu, because we pre-pandemic would have a friend's Thanksgiving on Thanksgiving Monday, a big group and a whole spread, a whole smorg. But this year we just had a few people over for a backyard, pie. We made apple pie and pumpkin pie and opened a bottle of port and you swung by with some olive oil ice cream.
Oh, right. Yeah. That's right. If you like take the macro view of your life, if you have to like maybe, you know, like if your life's on a bar graph or something, right?
Okay.
Like how do you think 2021 was like in relation to the bell curve?
I think the funny thing is that if I'm really able to focus on what's important, like my family and health and work and home and stuff like that. What a fantastic year. Yes, absolutely. It's been a really great year.
Great. That's awesome.
I do feel especially the last year, the noise outside of that focused area is really hard to ignore sometimes. Like the start of this year, like Shale, I know we don't talk about politics on this show, but like the start of this year with the storming of the US Capitol and all of that fallout from the American election made me extremely anxious. And of course the pandemic, and especially the way that the pandemic was playing out in our province, it just seemed like we hit this part, I can't remember if we've had this conversation, but it was like the episode of The Walking Dead where you realize that the real threat is not the zombies.
It's the zombies, other humans. But it's the people. Yeah.
Yeah. And it felt like that. I know it's completely changed even in the last few weeks, but it felt like that at some point this year where it's like, we know how to beat this, but we can't all get on the same page and make it happen. But so,
yeah.
And the climate change and that ridiculous heat wave, the unprecedented heat wave we had, all of that, like there was a lot of periods of intense anxiety for me this year. But it really is a lot of it. Most of it's outside of my direct control, obviously. So if I can center myself and think about what really does affect me and what I have control over, then I can't complain about much. That's for sure.
I don't want to like get too super personal here or anything. And like, you know, you don't have to answer this if you don't feel comfortable, but like, do you feel like pretty capable of centering yourself in that way? Or do you feel like it's pretty difficult sometimes for you to, you know, like kind of, I don't want to call all those like external factors that you were just talking about just like noise, because like obviously they are, you know, like important occurrences that are affecting the world that we live in and clearly affect our lives regardless of whether we choose to ignore them or not. But, and so I'm not like trying to say that, you know, it's a good idea to just ignore them or something, but like, you know, like giving them their like due importance, do you feel like, you know, you're still able to sort of like center yourself in the way that you're talking about, even though there are those, like, do you feel pretty capable of that? Or do you feel like it's really hard for you to do that sometimes?
I don't think that those concerns ever affect my ability at work or home. They don't actually disrupt my work as a chef or my role as a father or anything. It's more like a late at night kind of thing. I find, especially with work for me, like once I'm at work, all of that other stuff just disappears and that's all. I
kind of melts away for a bit. Yeah. Yeah. Well, like I don't know. Like I feel like for me, I do, like, yeah, the political things that you were talking about, like with Trump leaving office and how like seemingly politically kind of like infuriating that was in the States, or like, and that caused me quite a bit of anxiety. Mm-hmm. I have to say, like, that was, you know, probably one of the, I don't know, like politically the last 4 years have been very anxiety inducing for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, also, it's like, even in terms of my work life, the pandemic has like affected it quite a bit. And some of those effects have actually been positive for our business. Mm-hmm. And like, that's good. But yeah, like there's, you know, like kind of no escaping the like external anxiety that exists, like, you know, like in all of our staff and like how it affects people's you know, ability to feel like they are, you know, mentally healthy and fit to come into work, like on top of the, you know, like obviously like how much it like makes a difference in terms of how comfortable people feel coming to work if they feel at all like sick or anything like that. Mm-hmm. You know, like it really puts a dent in people's, in everyone, like myself included's, like ability to like be able to reliably always show up for work, and like, and that definitely makes things a little more stressful. Mm-hmm. But I have to agree that like personally for me, you know, like even though there are a lot of like external factors, this has been a really great year for Shale.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This podcast is one of the things that I really, you know, feel like has been like super positive and something that, you know, I'm pretty happy that finally, after, you know, quite a few years of thinking about it and trying to get something off the ground, it's actually going and we're doing it. And, you know, like you said, I really value the opportunity to have these conversations with you. It's sometimes tough to find the time, especially, yeah, like it's easy. We used to have these kinds of conversations at work all the time. Mm-hmm. And that was easy because we were in the same space like every day for like long periods of time or whatever. Mm-hmm. But when you don't necessarily have that like automatic interaction, it requires like some effort. And yeah, so like, you know, in terms of its ability to like allow me to keep my relationship with you, this has been like a super positive thing this year for me.
Mm-hmm.
Having this podcast to work on and think about and feeling good about creating something and putting it out there and getting good feedback about it and things like that. Mm-hmm. It's been great.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of other stuff like that, like, I don't know, this is a big year for me.
Yeah.
Like at work, we like totally kind of overhauled how we, not necessarily how we make our ice cream, but we moved into like a new production kitchen this year. Up until now, we've been producing all of our ice cream like basically in the shop that we had.
Mm-hmm.
But we opened a new shop this year and needed larger production facility. And so we moved everything to like an offsite kitchen. And so myself and the rest of the kitchen staff at Kind like had to do a whole bunch of sort of like extra, you know, like moving things around and getting things organized and trying to set things up. And it was like a really good challenge to see like, okay, well, you know, we have this new kitchen facility, which is great, and we have a lot more space, but like, how do we take advantage of that? And where are the things that are still going to like, I don't know, it's weird when you move into like a big new kitchen and you set up like a whole bunch of stuff and like suddenly you have like 4 or 5 times the amount of fridge space and 4 or 5 times the amount of freezer space that you used to have. And you're like, oh my God, this is going to be so amazing. And then like you start like making everything and you have like so much room to store things and everything seems like so great. And then after a couple months, you like start running out of storage space. Right. You're like, oh, like what? I did not really see that, you know, like we did a lot of math up front to figure out how much ice cream we were going to need to store and how much we would be able to store. Mm-hmm. And like, yeah, then you just like hit this part where you're like, oh, actually we need more than what we thought even. So yeah.
And is that because was a lot higher than you expected, or just because of...
I mean, like, it wasn't actually, like, that much higher than we expected, but, like, the way... I don't know, like, there were certain assumptions that we made about how much ice cream we would want to store and how much we would be able to offload to the shops and, like, ship to the shops on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And, like, I think in there... like there was just like some small changes after we started moving through like working out how we were actually going to do the production and deliveries, like the logistics of it. A few small changes to like, it made a little more sense to be trying to keep, like I think when I was originally conceptualizing it, I was basically in the mindset that we were going to pretty much be doing things in the similar way to how we had been doing them when we were producing in the shop. And that workflow was basically you're making the ice cream today that we're going to serve tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But once we had more space and the production facility was offsite, it made way more sense to like work off sort of a PAR based system where, right, you know, like, we want to have this much ice cream stored here at the kitchen as a backup for what we have in the shops so that even if we completely, like if we sell out of a whole flavor in one day at both of the shops, we still have enough on hand in our production facility to fully restock the like both shops mm-hmm. the following day. Mm-hmm. And then once we kind of like started down that path, I think that our estimates for how much we were going to need to produce in store were just slightly under what we actually in reality wound up producing and storing. Mm-hmm. And so it was just, things just got like a little tighter than expected, a little earlier than expected. And then I was like, how did this happen? Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it was great. Like it was a lot of challenge, and it was a lot of like retraining people on how to do things. And then we hired like a really, like, you know, we hired a whole bunch of new people this summer that we had to train and get up to speed really quickly. And, yeah. All of that was happening while I was, part of that was happening while I was off work because I damaged my biceps tendon this year mm-hmm. at work and I had to have surgery. I was off work for like a good, well, I was off, I was basically off work for like 6 weeks, but I was like fully off work for at least 3 to 4 weeks, mm-hmm. like basically doing absolutely nothing. And that was during the period when we really needed to be hiring all of our staff for the summer. And so that got a little crunchy. Mm-hmm. Some people at work really stepped up to help out in that situation. And everything, I think in the end wound up working out pretty smoothly, but I don't know. There's a couple days where I was like recovering from surgery, feeling like totally ineffectual, but also in the back of my head understanding that there was like this hiring process that was supposed to be going on at work that absolutely wasn't, and that like there was just no way around that.
Yeah,
there was a couple anxious days on the sofa.
Yeah,
but yeah, it's been really good. Like the other huge thing that happened for me this year, and I don't know, I kind of thought about like going into more depth about it on this episode, but I think there's more to talk about than maybe we can necessarily fully get into talking about it today. But like, yeah, like one of the big things that happened to me this year is that in February, I found out that I had type 2 diabetes, which like sounds like a negative, it sounds like a bad thing to have happen to you, right? And it is. Like, I mean, I haven't strictly been healthy, and like I put a lot of years into not necessarily fully taking care of myself, and you know, just thinking that it was okay to eat and drink whatever I wanted, and you know, like making rationalizations about my lifestyle. And you know, food and beverage is a huge part of my life, and it's like a big passion of mine, not just making food, but also eating food. And it's like, you know, I mean, I don't want to fully psychoanalyze myself in the middle of talking about my diabetes diagnosis, but like, you know, it was definitely, you know, a large part of how I was like a lot of my self-care was like had wound up being sort of related to unhealthy habits when it came to like eating and drinking.
I see it.
And then like finding out that I had type 2 diabetes, because I know, like, for one thing, my dad also has type 2 diabetes, mm-hmm. and he's on insulin, which I think would be a real pain in the rear. I'm not currently on insulin. Mm-hmm. When I was diagnosed, it was like a fairly, like it hadn't progressed all that far yet to the extent that it was, in my doctor's opinion, like, controllable with medication and diet. And finding that out, like, as much as it sounds like a bad thing, really lit a fire under my ass to consider making some like really deep and lasting changes to my lifestyle as it relates to my diet and, you know, like my activity level and my general health level. Mm-hmm. And it really, I don't know, just like, I don't know if forced is the right word, but like inspired me to confront some of those things and like really start down a different path, in terms of how, you know, like my relationship to food. Like I still love food and I still want to eat like amazing foods, but you know, like I think I just have a much better understanding now that I can have that relationship with food. I can have that passion about eating good food and trying new things and being excited about food and not have to like, not have to overeat necessarily to do that or to have that relationship, and that I can be in control of like, you know, like what I am eating and when I want to eat it and, you know, like how much I can potentially eat if I go out for a nice meal or something like that. You know, like I just have to sort of like, you know, whereas, you know, my attitude used to be like, oh, I'm going out for like a dinner in a restaurant that I'm probably not going to be able to go to very often, you know, like, or if ever again. And so I'm just going to order the whole menu and just, you know, like spend 3 hours like punishing myself with it. Whereas now I feel much more like I can go out and it feels even like a little bit more special now that I'm, you know, kind of treating those experiences as something like a little more sacred and a little more kind of like, I don't know, maybe like previously I felt like I was entitled to those experiences and now I feel like they're more of a privilege or something like that. But it's kind of like changed my relationship, to, eating good food in a lot of ways that I think have been really good for me. And like really making an effort to change that relationship has made it like I've never like I'm pretty heavy, like pretty fat. I have a lot of fat on my body and it's been that way for quite a while, like since my 20s. I've weighed quite a lot and been like overweight, and I have tried at certain points. Like I've never been like super uncomfortable with it in terms of like my self-esteem and that type of thing. But you know, I have always known in the back of my head that it's not healthy necessarily to be that way. And I have tried a few times to like push myself in a healthier direction, and I've had like moderate success with it like in the past. But I was never really able to change my relationship with food, which was the problem. Like I was able to change my relationship with like activity and exercise to try and push myself to like, you know, make my body a little bit healthier by being more active. But I wasn't necessarily able to like, change my attitude about, you know, like wanting to eat whatever I wanted, basically whenever I wanted. And sort of like, I guess the epiphanies that I've had this year about it since I found out that I had diabetes and like, and knowing people that have it and wanting to avoid feeling unhealthy, like for, you know, the remainder of hopefully a long life, you know, like I just knew that I was going to have to make some changes, and like changing my attitude. Like I feel like the diabetes diagnosis gave me the inspiration to change my attitude about how I was approaching my relationship with food, and then changing that relationship, really, and then additionally, like pushing myself to be more active and stuff like that has really, been a huge factor in my life this year, and has, I feel like I'm on a pretty good track to making that type of lasting change. This is kind of like, pounds is kind of a dumb metric, honestly. But I did start kind of like tracking a lot of metrics that had to do with my diet and my weight and the amount of exercise that I was doing once I started to sort of like take it seriously. Once I got the diagnosis in February, I started to weigh myself, which I never had really ever in my life, barely ever. And then I also started to track what I was eating on a daily basis in terms of like the actual meals that I was eating, and like and I was using an app to like get a rough idea of what the calorie content of like my daily food intake was. And I also, I mean, for quite a few years, I have been tracking my like exercise, like using an Apple Watch and stuff like that. But I really started to, try to, make sure that I was, you know, fulfilling my activity and exercise goals every day. And since the beginning of the year, so like I think it was like the second week after I got my diabetes diagnosis, I weighed myself. At that time, I weighed 285 pounds. And I got, and in the app that you get with the scale that I bought, like every scale, probably every scale that you can buy probably has an app now. Anyways, in the app, when I set up my scale, there was like, when you, like the wizard that walks you through at the beginning, when you like first sign into the app asks you like, if you have a goal weight or whatever. And I was like, well, I don't really have a goal weight. Like my doctor had said, like, you should try to lose some weight. Like, you know, in the next little while, like if you take off like 10, 20 pounds, that's going to do, that's going to go a long way to helping you like kind of pull back your insulin resistance. And I was like, yeah, okay, doc, I'll try or whatever. But then after I got out and really started thinking about it, I was like, yeah, I should do that. That's attainable. Like I can make that happen. So when I got the app and I was setting up my scale, and it asked me for my goal weight, and I weighed myself for the first time and I weighed 285 pounds. I was like, what's a total, like I wanted to set like a long-term goal weight. I was like, and I also wanted to do it like at a healthy rate. You know, like I didn't want to try to lose a whole bunch of weight right away and then put it back on. Like I, you know, like when I started thinking about it, I was like, okay, I'm doing this over the long term. I want to set goals that are long term. I don't want to set goals that are going to cause me to feel like I'm changing my lifestyle in a way that like, I just can't keep, I can't bear to keep doing it in like, you know, 3 months or something. I want to do it in a way where I feel like I'm changing it enough that I'm going to have an effect, but I'm not changing it too much that I'm going to like, you know, collapse my resolve or whatever. So I was like, okay, well, like, you know, what's like basically an unattainable goal weight for like me to lose within like the next year or 2 years? And I was like, okay, well, I think that I would feel pretty like stoked with myself if after like a year of like increased activity and like really watching what I eat, if I was able to get down to 225 pounds. But when I set that goal, I was like, this is a crazy goal. If you get down to like 245 by the end of the year, I think that, you know, like I felt like I would be proud of myself. But yeah, like I made changes that didn't feel totally outside of what like felt like, you know, sustainable to me. And like, we're not at the end of the year yet. And I hit my goal weight like 3 weeks ago.
The impossible goal win?
Yeah. Like 225.
Oh, awesome. Congratulations.
Yeah. So I don't know. Like, I mean, I know that like, I don't mean this to sound like a brag at all. And I don't mean to make it sound like it was easy. And it certainly like is not it like, it's different for everybody. But like, I feel like, you know, personally, I feel like getting the diabetes diagnosis really helped me focus in a way that I've never been able to focus before in my life on understanding that if I want to feel healthy and if I want to feel, you know, like I can still do the things that I love to do and, you know, be effective in my life and not feel like my, you know, not feel like my health is like keeping me from doing the things that I want to do, I'm going to have to make some changes. And it just like, it seems to be working. So that's like probably the biggest thing that happened to me this year. And it seems like a negative thing, but really, you know, in the balance has wound up being like a super positive, like maybe one of the best things that's happened to me in like the last decade or more, you know,
like in terms of, tell me if I'm, if this is dumb what I'm saying, but like obviously the sense of, empowerment that you feel from having accomplished that, that's one thing, but also like, it's likely that, you know, being at the weight you're at now, even with type 2 diabetes, like you are much more likely to live that long and healthy life than if you, even if you, you know, didn't have type 2 diabetes, but you stayed at your older weight, like that probably would have cropped something else up, right?
And exactly. And I'm sure that there are still like, there are still things that I probably should be doing, like be in better control of in my diet. You know, there's like a history of heart disease in my family. I still like, I have a pretty good idea of what my calorie intake is like every day, but like, I would say more calories than, like, I would say the ratio of like fat that makes up those calories is probably higher than it should be.
Okay.
In terms of like, you know, if I'm trying to have an effect on, you know, like the long-term prospect of heart disease or something like mm-hmm. that. But that's sort of one of the things where I've kind of been like, you know, like I can reduce my calories quite a bit, but I still liked, and I try to eat like good fats as much as possible. I use a lot of olive oil and like, I'm not really shy about butter and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I use a lot of that, but I do think that, you know, I have been kind of like slowly sort of starting to like use them in a bit more moderation. Mm-hmm. That was one of the things like up front though that really helped me, because like I had to basically drop carbs, and that was the toughest thing for me.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah,
like dropping bread and pasta and things like that. Like noodles are definitely without a doubt 100% my favorite food. Mm-hmm. You know, and I really had to like strictly cut out a lot of carbs from my diet to make a significant impact on my blood sugar. Mm-hmm. Another thing that kind of happened halfway through the year is I got constant blood glucose monitor, and that was super helpful because it allows me to basically like every time I eat a meal to see how much it affects or fluctuates my blood sugar. Mm. And so then I can like, I was able to do things like when I first got the diagnosis and before I got the constant blood glucose meter, like I was like extremely strict. Like I basically didn't eat, I ate barely any carbs for like the first 3 months because I really wanted to like try and get my blood sugar settled and get my like A1C, which is a blood factor that they use to determine how much your blood sugar fluctuates. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to pull that down in the first 3 months, like, and so I was very strict with myself in the first 3 months. Mm-hmm. In terms of carbs and sugar. But once I got the blood glucose meter, I was able to like get a way better idea of actually how much certain amounts of carbs of certain types affect my blood sugar. Mm-hmm. And that's allowed me to like be able to reintroduce some carbs back into my diet in a healthy way. It's more like, before I changed my diet due to the diabetes, like, you know, like a meal would be like 75% carbs and like mm-hmm. 25% protein and vegetables or something like right, that, yeah. You know, like, and now it's more like, it's like 75% protein and vegetables. And then maybe like, you know, 25% carbs. I have like a little, like if we make a meal, like sometimes like we've been ordering from meal services, you know, sometimes we'll get a meal that involves some kind of noodles or pasta. And then like, I'll just have a small amount of the actual noodle part and a little bit more of the vegetable part. Mm-hmm. And that like mm-hmm. kind of that usually works out pretty well. So that's been great too. Like having the tool to determine what things actually spike my blood sugar. Mm-hmm. Like for instance, I like to have really easy breakfasts, but easy breakfasts are usually really full of carbs.
Yep.
And so when I first started, I was eating bananas in the morning, which I thought, you know, should probably be okay because it's fruit. And like, you know, there's, and I know that bananas have like quite a bit of starch in them and they're quite sweet, but I was like, you know, it's like a whole fruit. It's got fiber in it. It's probably fine. And you know, like to get a quick breakfast, a banana, like I would say like 4 or 5 days a week was often like a banana plus like, maybe like a half of a protein bar or a banana plus like, an individual packed like little like cheddar cheese or something like that. Mm-hmm. That would be my breakfast like a lot of days a week. And then once I got my blood glucose meter, I'd like get up in the morning, have my banana, go to work, check my blood glucose, and it would just be like this giant spike.
Oh,
and
I was like,
yeah, like bananas are friggin' intense for your blood glucose. Like they have a lot of carbs and a lot of sugar. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I love them. I didn't want to have to give them up. And I haven't really given them up. I still eat them like maybe I try to like not eat them more than maybe like twice a week. It's something like an apple or a pear is like much less destructive in that way. And so I've just had to sort of like diverse my morning fruit intake a little bit and not always have a banana every day. And I don't know, it's just like, you know, those little things, you can kind of like change those things to like really make an impact.
Cool.
Once you have the data.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very empowering tool. The constant
Totally. And I don't know like the whole history of when they of how they were kind of like developed and when they came into like popular usage, but from what I understand, it's like a pretty new thing. Like I think that like 5 or 6 years ago there were still people saying that that would never happen. And yeah, now there's just like this little thing that I stick on my arm and then I just like tap my phone to it and it tells me what my blood sugar is over Bluetooth. It's crazy. What a world we live in, Alan.
The future is now.
Yeah. Okay, well, I didn't think that giving our overall impressions of our years was going to take an hour, but here we are.
Yeah.
I think the other things that I kind of wanted to touch on are like, yeah, some of our sort of like food, our like favorite food related experiences, and maybe some of like some of the podcast highlights. Do you have anything for either of those or?
I looked quickly. I looked at like the list of episodes. The ones as whole conversations that jumped out at me as particularly enjoyable or memorable were Rat Chef, in which we talk about the movie Ratatouille and the movie Babette's Feast, the Canadian cuisine conversation, and the childhood food memories.
Yeah,
those are the ones that I enjoyed the most. I think as a just one-off, random, memorable, hilarious, the whole Marco Polo story, bringing spaghetti back from the Orient. I just,
oh man, yeah, that's so good. I've totally forgotten about that one.
When it was one of Marco Polo's crewmen or something named Spaghetti who discovers how to make pasta,
right?
And of course, looked up the etymology of the word spaghetti as I was telling that story and just completely blew it all out of the water. So,
I mean, like you're way better at remembering things that happened on the podcast than I am. I don't know. I feel like I have a pretty ephemeral like memory when it comes to conversation in that way. I don't know why that is. I feel like I used to be way better at remembering things that I had said and that other people had said to me, but for some reason, like, I don't know if it's because we have this conversation and then I go back and like have to go through it step by step to do the editing, right, or something. But something about that, I think, like erases it from my memory. It's so weird. I have like double the exposure and half the memory of it. So that's weird. But yeah, like I really liked the conversation that we had in the Canadian cuisine episode. Like that was, I don't know, like it's interesting, I think, to talk about socio-anthropological like aspect of food culture and like those and things that touch on like what authenticity means in terms of like what food culture is. Like those things are very interesting to me. But I don't know, I wonder for our listenership if the, like those types of topics are like I don't know. I guess like for me, when we're like looking at the metrics of like how people listen to the podcast, it's not very apparent like who likes what, because we tend to have pretty consistent listenership, you know, over time. I think maybe if we had a lot more listeners, we would see like bigger dips and things like that, and we would be able to say, oh, I guess maybe people don't necessarily like it when we talk about food and racism. I don't know. But like
or like they don't want us to just reenact a food movie line for line.
Right, right, yeah. Like, it's just, it's hard to know. So I think we just, like, you know, talk about the things that we like to talk about. And I, you know, and I think that we have done some, like, you know, taken some suggestions from listeners and things like that. But, you know, up until now, it's just sort of like, well, you know, like, what's something interesting that we think that we can talk about this week? And I'm sure those, all of those different topics kind of hit different for different listeners and stuff. And so, like, that's cool. But anyways, all that is to say, or that's a long winded way of saying that I think you're a much better, like, podcast historian than I am. And so, like, when it came to thinking about highlights for the podcast, well, I kind of went back and looked at some of the things that I picked out to post on Instagram as, like, clips.
Great, yeah.
Because I think that some of those are some of our good moments. And if you want to have, like, a good sort of, like, retrospective of what the year on the podcast has been like, I haven't posted one for every episode. But, like, I think 80% of the episodes, like, after, like, the week after, have a clip associated with mm-hmm. them. And like, the clip usually is, like, a bit of a deep dive into, like, the essence of what that episode winds up being like. But I also asked my brother Ryan, because he's an avid fan and has been, like, listening to the podcasts up front and stuff to check for editing mistakes and things like that. I asked him what, like, some of his favorite moments were, and he had some, like, pretty interesting, some pretty interesting moments, some things that, like, kind of blew his mind. One of them was, like, the first thing that he brought up is that he just, like, it, like, kind of blasted his brain open when you were, like, saying that you thought that the effects in Tim Burton's movies looked janky. He was just like, what?
It's, generational, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess so. Although he's closer to your age than I
am. Is that right?
So
yeah, okay.
It's interesting. Yeah.
Sorry, Ryan.
Yeah, he also, like, really, like, the things I think for him that are, like, the most fun to listen to are, like, anecdotes about horrible shit that has happened to us.
Mm-hmm. So, like,
he really loved the story about when I dropped the plates in the fucking Fisk bar. Like,
yeah,
that was one of his, like, favorite moments. And I think one of our, like, for both of ours, he brought this one up too, and I was like, oh my god, yes, that is probably, like, the highlight of the podcast so far for me, is, like, finding out about your, like, secret hidden, like dirty little secret of, like, sucking the sauce out of the bottom of the Donair bag.
The shame sauce.
The shame sauce.
I can't remember. I think Spencer called it the shame sauce story or something.
Yeah. Oh man, that was a good one. Like, that was Alan. We may not have a million listeners, and we may not be producing, like, what could strictly be considered a professional podcast recording, but man, that shame sauce story, that's gold. Like, there's no denying the, like, cultural value of something like that.
I'm glad.
I thought that was great.
I'm glad to have shared it. Yeah.
Yeah.
To have unburdened myself with the
yeah, exactly. You can wear it as a badge of honor now. Yeah, and, like, I guess, like, overall, I'm just, like, really happy that we started this podcast, and you know, it's been, like, a really good positive part of a really good positive year for me, and yeah, that's great.
Awesome.
Another, like, yeah, I've had a couple experiences too where I've, like, run into people that I know are listeners and had conversations with them about it, and they've told me about, you know, how much they like listening to it and appreciate it, or told, you know, like, talked about some story or something. I've talked to Mike Forgy a few times about it. He seems to be, like, really into it, which is awesome.
Mm-hmm, cool.
Yeah. Also, like, I think I talked about it on the podcast as, like, follow-up or something, but, like, I had, like, a pretty good sort of, like, moment, like, when we had our year-end party for Kind this year. A former Kind employee Andy was there, and she was telling me about her experience listening to the Do Recipes Work episode.
Right, yeah, you mentioned.
And kind of like it, and kind of like told me that, you know, my assessment of how recipes like really hinder people's confidence in the kitchen, like really affected her. And, you know, like she felt like that it gave her like a boost of confidence to like to hear me say that recipes don't necessarily like recipes make people feel bad because they don't always work out the way that they're supposed mm-hmm. to. And it's not the people's fault. It's usually the recipe's mm-hmm, fault. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Like it was a really, that was probably one of the best conversations that I had externally about the podcast, you know, that where I felt like somebody was like, I said something, we said something, and somebody listened to it, and it really like, they really took it mm-hmm. in, and it really affected what they were doing. Yeah. And that, cool. that like, that felt really good. It felt like a kind of a watershed moment mm-hmm. or something mm-hmm. like where I was like, oh yeah, like, you know, this is something fun that we're doing and people are listening to it, and that's great.
So you think we should keep making it?
I do think we should keep making it. I
think we
really
should renew
hope you feel
our
the
podcast
same way.
Vows.
Well, we don't have to do it until what is it, mid-February or something. That's yeah. when we'll have to renew our podcast vows. We'll do it on our anniversary.
On a year-by-year basis, right?
I mean, like, I don't know, I guess maybe, yeah, for now it'll be on a year-by-year basis. I guess if we maybe like on our five-year anniversary we can up that a little bit, like if we get to 5 years and we decide that it's still going well, maybe we can make a five-year commitment.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I have it, hold on.
Oh, okay.
Don't make a five-year plan. Make a four-year plan, because 5 years is just Stalin. Hold, did I say it right?
I think so. Is that like a communism, or is that like
it's a
communism joke.
Because Stalin made those five-year plans. I don't know. That's what they taught us in social studies anyways.
They taught you that joke in social studies?
No.
Your social teacher was like, hey.
No, Steve at Burrow taught me that joke.
Oh, thanks, Steve. Yeah. What about meals? Got any great meal highlights? Actually, I hadn't thought of it kind of like when we were talking about topics previously, but I like just when we started talking tonight, I think I nailed down my number one favorite 100% best meal experience of 2021.
What was it?
It was when I came to your house and we sat on your front step and had oysters.
That was a good one.
At
the start of the heat wave.
Yeah, totally. Right at the start of the heat wave. And I happened to have some oysters. Why did I have those moisters? Moist oysters?
They were left over.
Oh, because my parents' anniversary.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, my parents had an anniversary party in June, and I bought a whole bunch of lobsters and oysters for it. And we didn't eat all the oysters, and so yeah, Alan and I had a little bit of an oyster feast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
that was probably my favorite, best, most, like, I don't know, like those like weird little meal memories that you have are like always my faves. Like, you know, just having like an amazing bottle of cava at the top of like Park Güell, is that what, like, I will never forget drinking a bottle of cava and having some ham at the top of Park Güell when I was in Barcelona. Mm-hmm. Like it wasn't like a fancy meal or anything. It was like a like 12 euro bottle of cava that I bought and some stuff that I got from a market. Right. But I just had this picnic and it was friggin' amazing. Mm-hmm. So yeah, those are always like my little faves. Mm-hmm. A glass of wine that I had at the top of a hike that I was doing in the Cinque Terre, that was pretty amazing too. Not this year, obviously. This is like a decade old food memory. But like all these, like, yeah, I have a lot of like these little picnic memories that I really cherish. Mm-hmm. And like other than that, I didn't eat out a whole lot in 2021. Like probably one of the most memorable meal type experiences that I had was like coming to Ernest's like twice in a week,
right,
and like trying your whole menu and then us talking about it on the podcast. Like that was also mm-hmm. You know, like really interesting and fun. And I hadn't eaten very many multi-course menu or like meals in like a long time. And it was really fun to like get back to that mm-hmm. and like, mm-hmm. you know, have that kind of service again. And, you know, just re-experience that and then have it also be like something that, you know, was in some way sort of like a fun little analytical kind of like study for us to do so that we could come back and talk about it. Like,
yeah, exactly.
That was really great too.
Yeah. I didn't eat out even. Yeah. I don't think I ate in a restaurant this year, to be honest.
Really? Yeah.
But one of the, odd, kind of silver linings of, of the pandemic has been, a lot of like this kind of big shift towards, casual and takeout friendly food.
Yeah.
Means that like the pizza and burger game in this city is really, really tight. Like
just like skyrocketing
like pizza. Yeah. We had pizza so often this summer, like takeout from Haido and Young and Restless and Seps and mm-hmm. all these fantastic places. I definitely ate more pizza this year than I have in any year previous. And there's lots to choose from.
Totally. What about burgers? What are your top burger picks?
I don't know. Do I have to do a, it's not really a conflict of interest cause I don't work there, but like, but Foxburger is by far my favorite. Not just because of like the, like it's whatever, it's a smash patty. It's got, always got great crust on it. It's always super moist. But I feel like what I really like about it is that they're not afraid to just lean into the like ingredients that we feel nostalgia for, even if they're not like high end or I don't know. I'm talking about like processed cheese, like American cheese.
Yeah, totally. You can't really have a smash burger without American cheese. And then also there's actually a wide variety of American cheeses. Like,
is that right? Yeah.
Of processed. Yeah. Like they're not all equal. Like a Kraft single is not the same thing as like, say like the American cheese slice that you get on a McDonald's burger and then, or the American cheese slice that you get on like, you know, a more robust, like smash burger that you might get at something like Shake Shack or something right. like that, you know? Like there are tiers and varieties of American cheese and some are definitely better than others. And the cheese on the burgers at Fox Burger is good.
Like if I think the three most important ones to me, like processed cheese, iceberg lettuce, and ketchup. I feel like these are things that some people who make burgers, maybe whatever, they just want to put their own stamp on it, or maybe they think that they're above those ingredients or something. So they put arugula on instead of iceberg. But right. for me, processed cheese, ketchup, and iceberg just like hit such powerful nostalgia buttons. The thing is like if they use those, but then they have fantastic patties. And then they also like, they do stuff in house. Like the bread and butter pickles are for my money, the best pickle in the city, at Foxburger. Yeah. I mean, like so they're like electric green colored and like so zippy and absolutely delicious. So yeah, Foxburger is my number one burger.
Sweet. Do you have a number two?
You know what I was thinking this week? So speaking of that shift towards casual and takeout, like the local Omnivore recently rebranded as Gravy Burgers and Fries. I've not had their.
Oh, really? I wasn't really aware of that. Yeah. I mean, I knew local Omnivore was like making a pretty big shift and stuff, and like they pretty sure they like closed down one of their shops or like the shop that I was going to anyways. Oh, okay. Or something.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm embarrassed to say I've never had their burgers, even as the local Omnivore, but I've heard that they're great. And yeah, just seeing what they're doing with Gravy, I really want to check it out.
Cool. Yeah. Like kind of for the most part for me, burgers and pizza have pretty much been off the menu this year. But like pizza is still kind of a stretch. Like I could have like, if I have pizza as a meal, I can have like one, maybe two slices, mm-hmm. which like, you know, I don't know, like that's fine. And that's probably like, actually for most people, it's probably like an amount of a totally perfectly reasonable amount of pizza to eat. But for me, for some reason, it feels like not enough or something.
Yeah.
Even though like I can have a meal that's equivalent to that amount of pizza and be totally fine with it. Like if I have like, you know, if I'm making a meal for myself at home and I have like, I don't know, like a half a cup of like, some kind of lentil situation that I've made, and some like chicken thighs or something like that. Like I can eat like a portion that would be equivalent to having like one or two pieces of pizza, but it feels like for some reason having one or two pieces of pizza feels like a small amount to me.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah. So yeah. And like pizza just has a lot of carbs. And so I've been trying to stay away from it. And also burgers have a lot of carbs, and they also tend to come with fries, and fries is kind of like a big no-no if I'm trying to stay away from carbs. Right. But I've been like, you know, since I've been monitoring my glucose and stuff, I've started to realize that I can eat things like a sandwich if I like maybe only eat part of the bun or something like that, which I know is like kind of annoying if you're trying to eat a burger or whatever, but I really love burgers and I would love to be able to eat them. And like taking half the bun off for me is like a reasonable compromise if I want to have a burger like every once in a while or something like that. So, so yeah, that's why I was asking if you have any other favorites besides Fox, because I'm fully aware of Fox and I love their burgers and I have eaten them several times, like before I kind of stopped eating burgers this year. And I will definitely go back and start if, you know, like if I start adding burger back into my diet, I'll, you know, Fox will be at the top of my list, but I was just wondering if there was anything else out there that I should, that I'm missing out on. But yeah, gravy sounds like a good option too.
And didn't Jack's Burger Shack just open a spot in Edmonton? Am I making that up?
Oh, did they?
I think so, yeah.
I like Jack's.
Yeah.
I find it super annoying to go there. Like,
because it's
how many times have you been there? Well, no, not just because it's in St. Albert. Like, sometimes I'm in St. Albert, and I'm like, oh, lucky, I'm in St. Albert. I'll stop by Jack's and get a burger. But, like, every time I go, I don't like ordering there. I find it, like, I don't know, super annoying and very disorganized. And usually in most cases when I go, they're out of a lot of things.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Like they're really busy and I go up and I'm like, and it, you know, like, and it's not usually like right before they're closing or anything. Like a few times it's been like a little bit later in the evening or something, but like I'll go and I'll like, I'll decide what burger I want and I'm like going to get a burger and fries and then I go up and order it and I'm like, oh, I'll have this burger. And they're like, oh, you know, like we ran out of that burger. We don't have this topping anymore. I'll be like, okay. In that case, I'll get the, quickly scan the menu. I don't know, double deluxe burger or whatever. And they're like, oh, okay. Yeah, we have that one. And then I'll be like, okay, I'll get that and fries. They're like, we're out of fries. I'm like, okay.
That's
like,
never
what
happened.
Do you have? No, it has happened. I've gone there twice and they've been out of fries. Oh. I'm like, isn't this a fucking burger? No, excuse my language. Isn't this a hecking burger joint? Like, what? I don't understand. Yeah, so I don't know. Like, I've been there probably a total of five times, and I would say like three out of five times there was some kind of weirdness with my order, and definitely twice they were like out of the thing that I wanted to order, and I was like, this is annoying. So I don't know, maybe they've been able to solve that problem. If it seems like they're expanding their business, maybe they're able to keep their production up. But yeah. And it was always very busy too. There was always like a lineup, you know, so and like that's cool that they're busy and I'm happy for them. But you know, like if you always have a lineup and then that means that every time a customer wants to come and get something, they have to wait for 15 or 20 minutes before they can order, you know, like, yeah, it's good that your business is busy, but maybe you should like try to adjust how you're handling your customer service to move things through a little bit more quickly so that maybe people the line, you know, like so that maybe you don't have so much of a lineup or that it's not, you know,
I can't
so
believe that someone who works for Kind food. Ice Cream is complaining about long lines. Oh my god.
Alan, I'm like so dismayed and at the same time like unsurprised and also proud that you brought that up. I'm having so many feelings right now.
Next summer.
I know. And as I was saying it, I was like, I know, but like honestly, the difference is, and like sometimes the Kind lineup is ridiculous. And in some instances, there's not really a whole lot that we can do about that. But we really do make an effort to make the service as quick as possible so that even if there is a lineup, and like the other problem that we're currently having in terms of our lineups at Kind Ice Cream is that due to the pandemic, we can only have like one party of people in the shop ordering at a time.
Yeah.
So the lineup, like what would normally be a bunch of people in the shop now looks like a long lineup because only a certain amount of people are allowed to enter at a time. Mm-hmm. But we really do, you know, make efforts to really streamline how quickly people can order ice cream and get in and get out. And those lineups, even though they look very long, are often not that long a wait.
Yeah. That's true. I didn't mean to say that as an actual customer complaining, but it's true that like when I think about like what's a place, like what's a food service place in Edmonton, you know, you just drive by and see long lineups at on a hot summer day. Obviously,
we're like the exactly. We're like the poster child for that.
for good reason.
I guess so. Yeah, I think though, like the thing that annoys me, like maybe I sort of like misstated my case a little bit about Jack's too. Is like you get there and there's a lineup, but it's not a long lineup. You're like four people back from the counter, but then it still takes 10 minutes for you to get up to the counter and place your order. You know, like that's what's annoying. You're in a short line, but it takes for friggin' ever. Mm. I'm just like, when are you gonna step on the gas back there? But they do have a good burger.
Yeah.
I really do. I really have enjoyed their burgers. I really did like the burgers that we had at Wilfred's too when I was working there.
Oh, yeah.
But I haven't been back to Wilfred's since they kind of reopened and sort of redid their menu and stuff. I'm not sure how their burger is now. I don't know, Alan. Maybe that's it. Is that it? That's it? Put it in the coffin and bury it in the...
We've been talking for 2 days.
Oh my God. What happened? It's already the new year. We have to start talking about 2022.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.